I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. This hour on The Mark Steiner Show, we're bringing you another hour of our Urbanite radio stories from the June issue of The Urbanite. In the mid-1990s, General Motors assigned a young Saturn salesperson from Los Angeles named Chelsea Sexton to help market its car of the future, the all-electric EV1. Sexton loved the slippery little two-seaters, which were only leased and not sold to their drivers. But GM canceled the program in 2001, eventually wresting the vehicles from their leaseholders and destroying them. The saga of the doomed EV1, chronicled in Chris Payne's 2006 documentary, Who Killed the Electric Car, transformed Sexton, who played a prominent role in the film, into a full-blown electric vehicle activist. She's the co-founder of Plug in America, a nonprofit advocacy organization trying to accelerate the deployment of electric and plug-in hybrid vehicles. And she's a consultant for Payne's sequel documentary, Revenge of the Electric Car, which is currently in production. She found some time to sit down with me for a conversation about the past, present, and future of the American auto industry. Chelsea Sexton, it's good to talk to you once again.
You as well.
So let me begin by just asking you some general thoughts here about where we are today. And there's all this stimulus money being thrown out, which I'll get to in more detail later with some questions about that.
Mm-hmm.
And we are in a real debate about the future of transportation in America. Rail, or build roads. And that's always been one of the arguments, rail or roads. And I wonder how you see the future transportation in terms of that argument, and throwing the whole question of personal mobility into that with the future transportation.
Yeah, we're certainly starting to see a shift in what people think of as personal mobility. And obviously, a lot of us aren't getting out of our cars anytime soon, but there is at least more of a focus on mass transit, on more walkable communities, on addressing the sort of first and last mile. Even if you use mass transit, how do you get to the station and how do you get from the station to where you're going? Is it small electric cars or sort of Segway things, or is it bicycles, or how do we connect all of these different things? Because if we can't make them convenient and have them fit into people's lives, it's not going to happen. So, you know, we're looking at almost a near-term, long-term goal and set of missives, which involves making the vehicles that we already have and the infrastructure we already have as good as we can, as quickly as we can, while also this long-term vision of how should we be reshaping communities and building new ones so that we eventually phase ourselves out of this problem.
So, but what do you think is the future of personal mobility? Let's say that, well, how does that fit into this equation? What will it be, do you think?
I think it'll be, you know, many of the components we already have, but shifting the priority of them. You know, right now, for sure, cars dominate. And there are certain cities that have some mass transit, others that don't. And I think we're going to see that evolve kind of in the other direction, the pendulum swing the other way towards, you know, less traveling at all, more telecommuting, more walking, that kind of thing. But also to the extent that we're going to move around, more convenient mass transit that makes sense and less emphasis on cars.
So less emphasis on cars, which I will ask you about in a second. But I'm curious then if you, when you envision the city,
mm-hmm.
and the city of the 21st century, and getting around in these cities of ours, because we are urban creatures, really. We're not going to have a gigantic back-to-the-land movement tomorrow morning, I don't think.
Right.
And cities notoriously, like Baltimore and other cities, or industrial cities, Toledo, Columbus, and places like that, don't have great transportation systems that connect well.
Right. Los Angeles is the same way.
So L.A. is the same. Exactly. L.A. is the exact same way. I mean, New York is an aberration almost when it
sure.
comes. So talk about where you think we may be going in terms of mobility and getting around in cities.
Well, I think to a certain extent we'll see some effort to make more cities look like New York or San Francisco with respect to availability of mass transit, as well as some interest in connecting cities together, like everyone in the East benefits from Amtrak running up and down the East Coast. And obviously we have nothing like that in the West. And so there's some interest in building sort of longer rail as well as centralized mass transit within cities. And then we're seeing cities evolve. For about the last 10 years, we've seen cities trend more towards mixed-use developments, live-work communities, trying to sort of do some urban rehab in city centers to keep people from having to go so far to do what they need to do in their daily lives. So, you know, the irony of what I do is I live in a very tiny town named after an oil refinery, but it's a whole square mile, which means that as much as I play with cars, I sometimes go days without getting in one because I can walk everywhere I need to go. I live in Mayberry, even though it's in Los Angeles. It's right next to the airport. You know, so that you can balance these kinds of things.
Mayberry.
Yeah.
But not with Andy. Not Andy Griffith's home, but I take it. But
if you visit this little town, you might confuse it. We do the whole sort of homecoming parades and all.
Really?
Yeah.
But I'm talking right now with Chelsea Sexton, who's an advocate for electric cars, who worked for General Motors in the mid-1990s to market their car of the future, the EV1. GM canceled that program just after a few years, and since then, Chelsea has become a leading advocate for electric cars in our country. She served as executive director of the Plug-in America Foundation and appeared in the documentary Who Killed the Electric Car? I've always, I guess, maybe correctly or incorrectly, associated you with automobiles. I mean, your history with GM, you're helping create the EV1, your push for electric vehicles. And I always
I'm a car girl.
You're a car girl, right? So that's why I thought you were a car girl. And on many levels, whether it's design or drive, right?
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
But you just talked now about living in a world where you almost you've gone carless for days.
Yeah. So, I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I mean, to the extent that I'm going to drive a car or to the extent that other people are going to drive cars, I want them to be as clean, as fun, as cool as possible. But it also doesn't mean that it's the right tool for every job. So, you know, if I'm going to drive, I want it to be fun and clean and cool, but it doesn't mean I always have to drive. There's a place for walking and biking and all sorts of other things. So I think you can minimize the impact of the cars by not always getting in one.
Okay. So do you really think that we can get to a balance here in the future of America between cars, rail, and pedaling or walking? I mean, I've always argued with mayors and everybody about, when you build roads, why don't you also build bicycle walk lanes on either side of the roads? Or why don't you put mass transit down in the middle of those roads or something? But, I mean, you think we'll ever get to a balance between all of that?
Yeah, I don't know if we'll get to an absolute balance, but I think that we can shift toward one, assuming we make it a national priority. And that remains to be seen if we will. There's a lot more enthusiasm for all of these things than there ever have been in the past, especially in Washington. But, you know, sometimes consumer will is short-lived, and same thing with political will. It tends to move around with every administration. So we have to establish it as a priority and stick to that.
And if there's any time to do it, it's now.
Yeah. Now or never.
I feel that way, too, sometimes about this, where we are now. Now, when we talk about electric vehicles, a couple of thoughts about that. When we look around the world and we see China and India and the Tata car in India and all the things people are developing around the world, and China's moving ahead even with electric vehicles, the world may see 2 billion vehicles in the near future. And let's say they're even eco-friendly vehicles, electric vehicles, if that is possible. All this electricity has to come from someplace. I mean, it seems to me, whatever we're looking at, whether it's the electric power to create cars of the future or the polluting fossil fuels we use now, are we still in a dilemma about how we're going to, on different levels, though, about how we're going to create all these cars and have us move around in them?
Sure. I mean, generating the energy is both a legitimate issue and I think a little bit of an overblown one. You know, obviously, we want to make the grid and any energy we put in cars as clean as possible. And there's a lot of concern over the use of coal to generate electricity in this country and in others. At the same time, I'm kind of the mind that coal is bad, but oil is worse. And particularly in this country, you know, we're just about 49% coal. And a number of studies have been done that show even if you are charging purely on coal, electric cars at worst are no dirtier than your best hybrid and tend to be about twice as clean. And in some areas of the country, they're up to 90% cleaner. So, you know, that's the worst case scenario today in the U.S. is twice as clean. the grid will get cleaner over time. I absolutely think that we need to, and we are, establishing more of an emphasis on renewable energy. You know, about half of the private EV drivers already have solar panels, and the cars came first. So we know that sort of using the gadgets, as it were, to drive infrastructure works as well, because once people get electric cars, then they become more aware of where their energy is coming from, more concerned about it, they want to make it cleaner. And so what all of this means to the consumer is that the dirtiest day, from an emissions perspective, your car will ever have is the day you drive it home from the showroom. And obviously, as we start looking at China and India and these other countries and building out billions of cars, obviously China's particularly dependent on coal, and we have to keep that in mind as well. But it also takes a really long time to deploy the billions of cars everybody's worried about, which gives us some time to also, in parallel, clean up the grid.
And question about clean up the grid in a minute as well. I'm making all these list of little things I want to make sure I come back to. But, I mean, with China seems in some ways to be moving ahead on the question of electric cars. I mean, they are investing money in ways
Absolutely.
We're not at this point.
Yeah, China just announced in the last couple of weeks a huge priority about developing electric cars. And on one hand, it's great because the cars are in some ways more important than where they come from. At the same time, I'd hope the U.S., you know, thinks of that a little bit as a call to arms, and other countries as well.
Well, will we, do you think? I mean, what is it? I mean, let's talk about that for a minute. Can we get there? Let's look at the American auto industry for a moment.
Do we have to?
Hard to talk about cars without looking at our own industry, I think.
Of course.
I wonder what's going to happen to this American auto industry. I mean, we see them almost as dinosaurs, but they've always been critical to this economy. They built the middle class of America, really, along with steel. Mm-hmm. And the workers and their unions helped build that middle class as well. So, I mean, what's going to become of this industry? And how is that going to affect America?
Well, I think that it's a little soon to say exactly what will happen. But what we know for sure is it's not going to look like it does in a few years from now. So all of the major automakers, and you know, everywhere, but particularly in Detroit, are at a crisis point. They have to lean their brands and, you know, sort of evolve their decision-making and get some good leadership. But at the same time, one of the biggest myths is that there's no smart people in Detroit. I hear it all the time. Oh, they're stodgy and they're stupid. And, oh, if it's Detroit, it's bad. And that's just not the case. There are some really innovative people in these companies, and the challenge is getting the leadership to allow that to bubble up and then do something with it. Historically, their biggest problem, even for advanced technologies, has never been building decent cars. The one thing that all the protests and trying to save electric cars and all that stuff showed is that when these companies want to, they can build cars that people get damn passionate about. Them getting behind their own vehicles and actually moving in a progressive direction and staying there even in early years when it's not as profitable as you want it to be, that's their dilemma. It's telling their own story. It's getting behind their own people and their own programs and sticking it out.
And I'm not surprised that you're saying that. I mean, you come out of that industry and you have a passion. You just kind of relate the passion about, especially auto designers and engineers that I've met and have a passion for their work. I mean, they love this stuff.
They do.
And is there GM, Chrysler, Ford, some innate corporate inability or some larger unwillingness or foresight to invest in electric and other sustainable technologies to build cars?
Well, I think it's evolving. Historically, obviously, there has been some struggle and unwillingness to do it. But I also think that we tend to unfairly anthropomorphize an entire company. You know, we hear all the time, sort of, what does GM think? Well, GM's made up of a couple hundred thousand humans, and so are all these other companies. So, you know, some of this comes down to just people issues. Humans tend to be afraid of change. We want to take the path of least resistance. You know, there's just some really basic innate issues about us that translate into larger corporate decisions. And sometimes it's a matter of some guy worried about his retirement deciding this is a bad choice for me and no one questioning that one guy. And you spread a few of those guys around and you end up with a trend. So, you know, has there been some inability? I don't know if it's inability. There's not been a lot of interest in the past, but that's shifting as well. And now we're seeing companies like General Motors, who ironically, given the history, was not only the first company to announce they were going to do a plug-in car, they announced two, and they remain among the most committed of any automaker. To them, they're all in at the end of the poker game, and this is the future of their company. There are other companies that are sort of dabbling in the space and are not nearly as invested, and there are some other companies that it's complete greenwashing. So there will be a variety of commitment, but it's clear that they're recognizing some of their historical mistakes and wanting to do better, and they still struggle. I mean, these guys are still clumsy, and I still talk to them all the time. Even I end up trying to coach them of how to talk about these things without getting in their own weeds. But the interest is there. The passion is there. Whether they can do it enough and quickly enough and enough volume to save their companies remains to be seen. And that's the unfortunate irony, is we finally have, after 10 years, gotten all these guys back to where they left off, and they may not survive at all.
And what happens if they don't survive, do you think?
Well, you know, there's a lot of debate about what should happen, what these companies deserve to have happen based on their historical mistakes. And, you know, on one hand, it is not our responsibility to continually bail them out. On the other hand, it would be in our national best interest to see them pull themselves up out, you know, by their bootstraps and get going, because certainly a huge chunk of our economy depends on this industry, and it's a massive point of national pride. I mean, we are the car culture, and how sad is it if we end up with no American car industry as a result? So, you know, it's going to be difficult. It's going to be frustrating as hell. Watching automakers is like watching my children. You know that you have to let them struggle and figure it out on your own, and you so badly want to step in and say, let me just show you.
So, right, you know. Right, right.
And they go, that's great. Piss off.
Right. So, they do that, don't they? Yes, they do.
They do.
Yes,
yeah.
They do.
I know what I'm doing. So, you know, it's not going to be easy, but it is what we need to do.
I'm talking right now with Chelsea Sexton, who's an advocate for electric cars, who worked for General Motors in the mid-1990s to market their car of the future, the EV1. GM canceled that program just after a few years, and since then, Chelsea has become a leading advocate for electric cars in our country. She served as executive director of the Plug-in America Foundation and appeared in the documentary Who Killed the Electric Car? So, when you look at our car industry here in America now, and we see what the president has said and changing leadership at the top. And I mean, sometimes I wish he would do the same for Wall Street that he's doing for Detroit, but they're not yet. That I wonder who makes it move in a certain direction, and what does it take? Do you have to turn it over to the guys who run Tesla? Do they have to be put in position to run a General Motors to make it work?
Well, I think that certainly Detroit could benefit from some new blood, you know, whether it's Silicon Valley blood or not. But at the same time, one of the frustrations, even with this newfound enthusiasm, this effort to save this industry, is that you really have to know the industry you're trying to manage. And so there is some danger to just let's turn everything over to Steve Jobs. You know, there might be some really good people that could come in and do that. And you know, Ford has had some success with bringing in Alan Mulally from Boeing, not the auto industry. At the same time, others have brought folks in from other industries, and it's not gone nearly as well. So you have to be incredibly selective, and even handing it all over to the Tesla guys, who are brilliant and passionate as the day is long, they also come out of different industries and have had their own struggles as a result. They started kind of saying, we don't want anyone from the car industry, and now they're going, yeah, not everyone in Detroit is stupid. So, you know, the little guys, the entrepreneurial folks, whether it's Bright or Tesla or Fisker, have this great innovation that the larger automakers struggle with. And the larger automakers have some really valid knowledge in manufacturing, capacity, parts, suppliers, all sorts of things that the little guys could depend on. And ideally, I'd love to put one of each in a box and shake them up and say, go to it. I think, you know, some of the debates we ought to be talking about with respect to the bailout have more to do with the conditions put on these large automakers. And you know, maybe one of them is that they provide some capacity to a smaller guy. But you know, we have to start thinking more creatively about how to move all of this forward rather than just throwing more money at the same problem. So we have to fix the industry, but we have to change it too.
I'm really interested in what you just said, especially about how you take a corporate behemoths and make them creative. There are creative people inside of them. You are one of them. There are creative people inside of those companies. But they also can get kind of damped down and lost inside of the morass of these bureaucracies.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you – I mean, this is the time to really wrestle with that in America. How do you make a General Motors, Ford, Chrysler creative engines that move us ahead with electric and perhaps hybrid, which we'll talk about in a second? But, I mean, how do we get there? I mean, I know you've wrestled with this.
Yeah, and actually one of the things that I have seen in the last couple of years that I find incredibly intriguing is kind of the mixing up of veterans in the same conversation. I've seen some fascinating conversations with veterans from, say, venture capital and executives in the auto industry, where they each come from a completely different place, but they know their stuff, and you put them in a room, and by the end of it, they're going, well, I don't know, why couldn't we do it this other third way that none of us had thought of? And they sort of inform each other. You know, same thing, even with the DOE and with the new administration and all the folks that are getting in there and wanting to make changes, and a lot of it, creative ideas are coming out of that as well, but they need to be balanced also with the industry veterans that have worked the front lines, that have marketed to customers, that know what they want. You know, even saying, you all will go forth and build electric cars, legislating that may not be effective if it's the wrong kind of electric car, or if it's the wrong metric. If we said, oh, they all have to go 300 miles, that would actually be a really bad thing for the technology and for the movement.
Why would it be bad?
Well, I think it's a bit arrogant for either automakers or policymakers to decide on behalf of the American consumer, this is the one thing that you want. So I tend to think that variety is a good thing. But at the same time, 80% of people drive less than 40 miles a day. And as much as we all thought 300 miles were the thing to have, we found out actually that the most successful cars were 100-mile cars, EVs. So if we all said, oh, it's got to go 300 miles, that aces out really what people want and forces the manufacturing of cars that are vastly more expensive than we need or what that consumers will buy. So it requires the true understanding of historically what people want, but also how they can be educated differently. You know, we didn't start out. No one looked at their Walkman and said, I wish this were the size of a deck of cards and I could watch TV on it. Nobody would have thought to ask for an iPod.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we all got darn used to them when they came out. And right now the industry is expecting consumers to ask for iPods when they look at a Cadillac. You know, you can go out and ask people, you want an electric car? And their answer is, I don't think that's possible. It's the number one thing we hear when we run around with our first little movie. I didn't know electric cars were possible. Well, of course they're not going to ask for them then. So, you know, it's educating everybody. I run around educating policymakers, automakers, consumers, and pushing each of those three against the other two. And in the middle is the solution.
That's fascinating. And since we are such a individual transportation world, and I think we are in America, I mean, it would be tough to get me out of my car in many ways. I love driving in my
car.
I love my car, you know, and I love driving.
Yeah.
I really do. I can just go for days. I just like getting in the car.
Right. So
I'm talking right now with Chelsea Sexton, who's an advocate for electric cars, who worked for General Motors in the mid-1990s to market their car of the future, the EV1. GM canceled that program just after a few years, and since then, Chelsea has become a leading advocate for electric cars in our country. She served as executive director of the Plug-in America Foundation and appeared in the documentary Who Killed the Electric Car? So, two questions with this. One is with electric cars. And we talk about 300 miles is not the answer for everybody. But those people who want to drive across America, who want to go drive from Baltimore, Washington, D.C., up to the Rocky Mountains or go to Banff, and make a road trip out of it.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do that in an electric car?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of layers in there. First, I'm with you. I'm a girl that likes torque and horsepower more than most guys I know. So I don't want to get out of my car completely,
right.
And I don't think that we're going to, you know, yank people out of theirs. So, you know, part of it is given that we love our cars, let's create the best cars possible. Certainly, I find the Tesla wicked fun to drive.
I have a friend who just bought one. They're amazing cars. But they're really hard to get in and out of, but they're great cars.
Well, I find that you sort of put it on.
Right, you wrap it around yourself and get in. Right, exactly.
Right. You know, and that's not the car for everybody either, and it's certainly not, you know, economically feasible for me.
No, $150,000 bucks, I don't think I can do that today.
Yeah, that's a little out there. But we have a coming generation of electric vehicles and plug-in hybrids that are, you know, $25,000 to $40,000, which is still not cheap, but a lot more doable. And, you know, the other issue is, and this is starting to happen already, a trend towards right tool for the job. We're starting to see people get into smaller cars. The Smart is wildly popular. So was the, you know, Honda Fit and Toyota Yaris, these small economical gas cars. But also, we have this really cool plug-in hybrid technology. It's like the best of both worlds, where you might have 40 miles of electric range and then a hybrid backup. So Monday through Friday, you may not use gasoline at all, but if you want to drive to Vegas on Saturday, you still could in the same car. And then other people will get pure electric cars and rent one, or car share, or use flex car. I mean, there's sorts of those other models that we need to use to help transform people about the way they think of their cars. Not take them out of their cars, but maybe use them a little differently. So maybe get a Monday through Friday car, and the two times a year that you drive long distance, you rent one, you borrow one, you exchange one, whatever. And a lot of people fly. So a lot of folks, you know, we think of this. The number one question we get is, oh, my God, what do I want to do when I want to drive cross country? Because we have that sort of almost innate Route 66 sort of cultural thing ingrained in us.
There's
and
no
I
question.
Totally get it.
Right.
But at the same time, my answer is always, when was the last time you did that? Most of us do it maybe once in our lives.
Right.
So this is largely a psychological concern. You know, what do I do when I want to, you know, drive cross country? What if I run out of battery? And it's funny because within a couple of weeks of driving electric, that falls away. People kind of go, oh, you know, I don't drive nearly as much as I think I do, and I have all this range left at the end of the day, and it's really kind of cool that I get to pull into my garage and plug in, and my car's full in the morning, and I didn't have to go out of my way to a gas station, and it's, you know, clean and quiet and God, it doesn't hurt that I could take a Ferrari because the electric motor has so much torque that I could take anything off the line. That doesn't suck either. So.
And electric cars do have torque, don't they? It's amazing.
They do. They have a tremendous amount of torque.
I couldn't believe how fast the Tesla went.
Oh, 0 to 60 in 3.9 seconds.
I was like, what?
Yeah.
It's just amazing.
They're wicked fun.
So I'm talking right now with Chelsea Sexton, who's an advocate for electric cars, who worked for General Motors in the mid-1990s to market their car of the future, the EV1. GM canceled that program just after a few years, and since then, Chelsea has become a leading advocate for electric cars in our country. She served as executive director of the Plug-in America Foundation and appeared in the documentary Who Killed the Electric Car? So I wonder when you, staying with a theme here for a moment about our love affair with automobiles in America, you're also connected for many reasons with the environmental movement, the movie you made, Who Killed the Electric Car, and all the rest. You like become a hero, heroine of that movement in a lot of ways. Well, you have.
It's good you can't see me blush on radio.
How does that fit with so many other people in the environmental movement who are, I would say, almost like anti-car, kill your car, get in a bus, get on a train?
Yeah, I mean, I would remind folks that, unfortunately, this whole movement, whether it's the alt-fuels movement or the environmental movement or the energy security movement. We have a whole bunch of reasons to do this. But all of us collectively have been the best circular firing squad I have ever seen. So for some reason, it's been pitted as an either-or scenario, either better cars or mass transit, either electric or, you know, plug-in hybrid. We've had these either-or scenarios for some time. And, you know, am I a gearhead? Yeah. Do I want people to get better cars? Am I sort of pro-car? Sure. But I'm not out trying to get people to use cars instead of other solutions. All these things need to happen in parallel, and we need to make each segment of transport as good and efficient and logical as it can be. And transport includes feet and wheel and bicycle wheels. So, you know, I don't think that it's necessarily at odds, but I'm very aware of the sort of environmental expectation of, you know, if you're really a good enviro, you should get out of your car and walk and ride the bus and all those sorts of things. But, you know, I'm a geek first and yeah. enviro second.
I have to tell you, I do hate the bus. But I, when you think about where America could go, I mean, President Barack Obama recently talked about the his desire to build mass rail to mm-hmm. the West.
Yes.
And, I mean, that's – we used to have a wonderful rail system in America. And it took you everywhere. And here in Baltimore, with the auto industry that it did in other cities, helped kill our mass transit system. We could go anywhere from anywhere in Baltimore by trolley. I mean, everywhere, by electric trolley, everywhere. It was amazing. That's gone. But that could come back. I mean, there's no reason if we want to invest. It seems to me it's how much you want to invest and how committed we are as a government culture and as entrepreneurs to invest in this new transportation world that could marry all these things.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, without question, this is not a technology problem. It's an issue of will. There is no new technology that would be required to build out a rail system or to build electric cars or to do more city-centralized mass transit inside of a city. All of these things have been done, will be done, and certainly we're creating better ways to do them, but there's no chicken-egg problem. There's no, we have to wait until it gets this good before we can start. It's completely inside of ourselves. Do we want to take the time? Do we want to spend the money? Do we want to solve the not-in-my-backyard problem that always exists with all of these things?
Mm-hmm.
You know, someone has a problem when you put solar panels out in the desert where nobody sees them.
Right.
There's always issues.
Right.
But it's a matter of, you know, what's worse? And where do we want to go as a country? And I love the across-country sort of rail and mass transit priority. I love that he's finally, you know, the first president to say, we're going to do 1 million cars by 2015. And there's a lot of debate there about whether that's doable. And we ran around Washington yesterday interviewing senators and stuff about, you know, what do you think of this goal and this technology? And there were senators that were saying, oh, well, God, it's going to be really tough, but you have to set stretch goals. And that's completely valid. And then there are other ones that are standing there saying, you know what, we're going to look back in 2015 and wonder why we were so modest. You know, there comes a point where you have to think big to get big.
Yes. So in this, taking off what you just said, I mean, I'm curious about this new documentary you're working on. Where is this going to take the conversations you left off with who killed the electric car?
Well, the sequel's called Revenge of the Electric Car. only fitting, right?
That's great. And I like that.
Yeah. So in this film, we're chronicling the efforts and human interest stories of trying to bring cars back. What's changed? Can a company like GM save itself with the Volt? Can a little company like Tesla make it? Can a little Midwestern company like Bright Automotive, who's made up of a whole lot of former EV1 veterans, do they have the solution? And is there room for both of those types of models to exist? And then, you know, the human interest, the characters involved, and the fact that even once we decide what the solution is, we still tend to have a historical problem of getting out of our own way. And we get lots of emails from people who say, oh, well, just call up your buddy Mel Gibson and all the old EV1 people, and let's just go start a car company. And as the Tesla folks will tell you, it ain't that easy. So, you know, we're dispelling some myths along the way as well about, you know, this is a tougher challenge than it looks, and yet there are these people that still are so incredibly committed that they're doggedly going to make it happen. And, you know, it's in our best interest that they do. And yet it's still a relatively small little group of pioneers that are out there just every day, day in and day out, being the unsung heroes of moving our society forward.
Don't go away, because when we come back, Chelsea Sexton will stay with us for more talk about the future of transportation in America. Urbanite Radio Stories on The Mark Steiner Show are made possible by Baltimore Mediation, the first mediation firm in the state of Maryland specializing in separation and divorce and business and workplace conflicts, located in Baltimore at www.baltimoremediation.com. So stay tuned. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. This hour on The Mark Steiner Show, we're bringing you another hour of our Urbanite radio stories from the June issue of The Urbanite. In the mid-1990s, General Motors assigned a young Saturn salesperson from Los Angeles named Chelsea Sexton to help market its car of the future, the all-electric EV1. Sexton loved the slippery little two-seaters, which were only leased and not sold to their drivers. But GM canceled the program in 2001, eventually wresting the vehicles from their leaseholders and destroying them. The saga of the doomed EV1, chronicled in Chris Payne's 2006 documentary, Who Killed the Electric Car, transformed Sexton, who played a prominent role in the film, into a full-blown electric vehicle activist. She's the co-founder of Plug In America, a nonprofit advocacy organization trying to accelerate the deployment of electric and plug-in hybrid vehicles. And she's a consultant for Payne's sequel documentary, Revenge of the Electric Car, which is currently in production. She found some time to sit down with me for a conversation about the past, present, and future of the American auto industry. We'll rejoin that conversation now. So what are the problems with developing an electric car that is actually can actually work and be sold? I mean, you said you alluded to problems that Tesla or Bright or any of the other companies might be having, Fisker. So what are the roadblocks? What are the things they have to overcome? What are the problems that they're finding in creating this new electric car?
Well, I don't think it's an issue of creating a car that works and is sold. And you know, the problems that I allude to for companies like Tesla or Fisker or Bright are not technology problems. It's just that the auto industry is incredibly expensive to play in. It's entrepreneurial small company capital issues. I mean, this plagues everybody in all industries. Of starting a company is not cheap, and starting one in the auto industry really isn't cheap. So, you know, these companies are really actually becoming quite successful, all things considered, and yet it is a struggle. I mean, part of the reason that Detroit is struggling is because of capital, and on a micro level, same thing with the entrepreneurs.
So, talk a bit about that. I'm curious for everybody to understand the difference between Tesla, Bright, and Fisker. And that before I go off, how they fit into Detroit, if they do. But let's talk about what those three companies are, what their different directions they're taking in terms of creating the electric car.
Well, each are entrepreneurial companies building some sort of plug-in car. Tesla and Fisker are California-based. Tesla, Northern California, Fisker, Southern. And then Bright is out in central Indiana.
And Bright is the one from your old colleagues at EV1, is that correct? Is that
what you're
saying? Right.
Yeah. So, and they each have taken some different approach. Both Fisker and Tesla are building high-end, plug-in sports cars. I mean, sexy stuff. And it's great because they get a lot of headlines and they capture the public's imagination and know they're not the cars for everybody. But it got people really excited about the technology. And there's this perception of electric drive as sort of ugly golf carts. And it's unfortunate because it's never been true, but it's an enduring perception. So at least what these companies have done is shatter that myth. So Tesla does an all-electric two-seat roadster. And Fisker is going to deploy a sort of Jaguar Aston Martin styled plug-in hybrid at the end of the year, and these cars have been wildly fascinating. Tesla sold 1,200 of them before they put the first Roadster on the road. They've now delivered about probably 300-350 cars, and people love them. And then Bright is taking a completely opposite direction. They are the ultimate in humility. They are deeply qualified. They all come out of the auto industry, and they're building a fleet van. So their idea is that the best way to offset a lot of petroleum quickly is to replace all of these fleet vans we have running around, and that companies like Cox and Coke and Duke Energy and, you know, all these fleets, but also all these companies that want to do something, that want to demonstrate their progressive and environmental mindset, would embrace that kind of a vehicle. So they build it ground up. They're using aluminum instead of steel to make it lighter so you don't require the same number of batteries, and to try to make it as economical and as low impact environmentally as possible. So it's a complete 180 from somebody like Tesla, and yet they're both really valid. There's room for both of them, and they are sort of the front runners in the entrepreneurial space right now.
But to make this work, it's like my uncles who were in retail years ago when I was a little boy. Yeah, how do we do it? Volume. You know what I mean? You've got, it's GM, Ford, Chrysler. Someone has got to do this on a massive scale if the majority of Americans are going to be able to drive and afford electric vehicles or electric hybrid vehicles.
Absolutely. And one of the things that the advocates, that people like me try to do, is drive both ends toward the middle. And a lot of people would dismiss a company like Tesla and say, oh, you know, they think they're going to call it Detroit and they never will. And you know what? The reality is that Chrysler's not going to, you know, make something, or Ford's not going to make something because some entrepreneur did. However, there's absolute proof that these companies pay attention to the smaller guys. If you go to GM, every engineer on the Volt project knows that there are 6,831 cells in a Tesla. So if you think they're not paying attention, wrong. If you look at the new Dodge Circuit, Chrysler's new EV, it's an awful lot like a Tesla. And so certainly we're seeing evidence of some of these companies at least paying attention, learning from the innovation, and possibly taking cues from some of the little guys. So, you know, there is merit to each approach. There's certainly room for each approach. And, you know, I do hope ultimately they're able to actually get together a little bit and maybe even cooperate. There might be the Carroll Shelby of electric cars, the partner with Ford kind of thing. There's certainly potential for those sorts of creative ideas. But in the meantime, we have these little companies that are going, you know what, I'm not going to wait for Toyota. I'm just going to go out and do it. And God love them for it.
I'm talking right now with Chelsea Sexton, who's an advocate for electric cars, who worked with General Motors in the mid-1990s to market their car of the future, the EV1. GM canceled that program just after a few years. And since then, Chelsea has become a leading advocate for electric cars in our country. She served as executive director of the Plug-in America Foundation and appeared in the documentary Who Killed the Electric Car? So the key to all of this seems to me one of the keys are batteries and battery technology.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's something that is still being developed. And that isn't that really the key to how make all this work?
Battery technology is certainly one of the keys. And, you know, it's an issue of it already being good enough to start, and yes, we want it to get better. You know, right now batteries are expensive. And even though they're half the weight of what we started with, they're still heavy.
Right.
And, you know, we want both of those things to improve. And indeed, lithium batteries so far are still improving about the rate of 8% a year. So if you look at that, every 8 years, your batteries will either be half the weight and cost or twice the range, depending on your priority. And certainly lithium is not the be-all, end-all. We've gone through three battery technologies in the last dozen years in cars, but also in cell phones and computers and stuff. We had lead acid, we had nickel metal, now we're on lithium. There will be something that comes after that. At the same time, the most popular battery we had on EV1 was lead acid. It wasn't nickel metal with the longer range. So yes, we want battery technology to get better, but we found an awful lot of people that were really quite content with a 100-mile car, especially if that was a cheaper car, than waiting for the ultimate. It goes back to the whole right tool for the job. But if we don't start, this economy of scale will never take over and they'll never get cheaper.
And it's interesting, though, that I mean, there are always consequences whatever we do. They're beyond the technology or what we create. And lithium is one of those. I mean, and the raw material it takes to create these batteries that come out of the Congo and other places are creating a different kind of crisis that is devastating to those countries.
Yes, there are absolutely consequences everywhere. And the whole sort of lithium both shortage and where it comes from notion is the latest sort of urban legend we have to deal with. And it's not that it's not a legitimate issue, although, again, it's an overblown one if you look at the volume of cars we're talking about and the amount of lithium that's required compared to supplies. But we have to be careful. And actually, with respect to vehicle batteries, the issue for us is actually less sourcing the raw material. The potential danger is manufacturing capacity. There is a growing concern of, are we shifting from foreign oil to foreign batteries? So there's a huge emphasis right now on building out domestic battery manufacturing so that we are still truly independent and not having to rely on China or Japan or somebody else to source all of our automotive batteries, especially as companies like China really end up putting a priority on developing their own. They're going to want to keep their batteries for their cars. You can't blame them. So, you know, we need to ensure that we can move our own projects forward as well. And then also it goes back to lithium is not the be-all, end-all. There are already people working on the next thing. So we have to keep that in perspective as well, that this is not the only technology we're going to depend on for the next 100 years. And it may not even be the best. You know, ultimately, it probably won't. But it's the best of what we have right now, and we have to be responsible about it, but we still have to start.
Your old group that you founded, Plug In America, I was thinking about the history of all this in many ways, and there's this great picture on their website of in 1912 of a woman plugging or unplugging her electric car in 1912.
Yes.
I love that picture. I mean,
I mean, the irony is electric cars are well over 100 years old. They used to be more popular and more common than gasoline cars, and they're kind of the first chick cars. Women loved them because gas cars at the time had to be cranked. They were dirty. They were smelly. Electric cars.
Anything associated with men,
clean,
huh?
They're quiet.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
You said it, not me. Yeah, and then Kettering invented the electric starter, and that enabled, you know, no cranking on the gas cars, and gas cars took over because of the range issue. So we are sort of taking 100 years to get back to where we started, but I'd like to think we've improved those electric cars in that time.
I think we probably have. Have you ridden in a Volt?
I have not ridden in a Volt, and I take great issue with that, let me tell you. In fact, I have issued a little bit of a challenge to all these automakers about who's going to put a car in my driveway first, because ironically, I still drive a Saturn after all of these years.
Well, I can ask you that. Every interview I've seen, you say, I drive my Saturn.
I do. I still have my little Saturn. I don't want to buy another car, and I won't buy a hybrid even, until there's something available with a plug. So I drive the smallest Saturn they make, as little as I can get away with. And I love the car. It's fun to drive. I actually drive manual trans in LA, which is makes me in the minority. And, you know, when someone comes out with a plug-in, I'll get it. But until then, it's a good little car.
It is a good little car.
Yeah. But I do, I mean, I'm fortunate in that I get to run around and drive a lot of the electric cars that are coming. And I've driven the new Mitsubishi, and I've driven the Tesla, and sort of go through the line. But, yeah, I haven't been in a Volt yet. And I think that given the history, that's just wrong.
I would say yes. I mean, they should at least let you get in it since it's coming out and see what that's like.
Well, they have some mules, but they are building 80 Volt prototypes this summer, and I'm thinking that one of them ought to land in my driveway.
Well, let me know. I'll come out there. I want to see what that's like.
Heck, if I get one, I'll come to you.
Okay, good. I'll do an interview in the Volt.
There you go.
I'm talking right now with Chelsea Sexton, who's an advocate for electric cars, who worked with General Motors in the mid-1990s to market their car of the future, the EV1. GM canceled that program just after a few years, and since then, Chelsea has become a leading advocate for electric cars in our country. She served as executive director of the Plug-in America Foundation and appeared in the documentary Who Killed the Electric Car? So tell me what you're finding in your work so far in your documentary in terms of the openness or reticence of leaders of industry and political life to understand what we have to do and make the necessary investments or whatever that is they have to do to make this new world happen.
Yeah, it's interesting because as hard a time as we had getting people to be in the first film, you know, Michael Moore has made it difficult for some of us to make documentaries. Everybody wants to be in the second one. You know, and so we've had really unprecedented access. You know, GM, Tesla, others have really said, yeah, come on in.
Even GM.
Talk to Bob. Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, they were the first to invite us in. And sure, come on, talk to Bob Lutz, no problem. And so they have been, all of them, very, I think, open to us. And I think that, you know, having made the first one, and it is a fair and balanced film, I think we ended up with some cred to build from. But what we've found is that people are really interested in talking about these issues and know they don't have them solved, and they are clumsy from time to time. And there is a lot of, God, let's sit down and learn from the 90s and not skin the same knees again. And So they do struggle a little bit, and they do skin some of the same knees, but there is clearly an acceptance that we have to do this, that we have to move forward, that there may be differing ways to do it, and that's all still being parsed. But the will to do it is starting to happen, and it needs to grow, but it's in sort of seedling stage right now, and it's more than we've ever had.
So I have to ask this question. Given your role in the EV1, when the now deposed GEM CEO Rick Wagoner said that axing the EV1 electric motor program and not putting the right resources into hybrids was his worst decision. Have you spoken to him about that since?
I personally have not. And both he and Bob Lutz made that statement, although I differ with them a little bit because they sort of frame it as it was a huge mistake from a PR perspective. And so it was a mistake, but only because we kind of got a baseball bat up to the head with the film and all that. It's not the same sort of sincere we screwed up. Larry Burns, who's the executive of vehicle technology, actually, I think, said it better because he said, look, we were 10 years ahead. It was our worst decision because we lost 10 years, and now we're playing catch-up instead of leading. That's the real issue. But, you know, on one hand, I like and I think it's necessary for those statements to be made in order for, you know, people to want to support these companies, they have to do better, and part of doing better is recognizing you didn't do well in the past. At the same time, I think there's a limit to how much they need to be flogged, how many times they need to say they're sorry. And I do think absolutely there is an absolute need for some humility in Detroit right now. But I think that for the most part, they get it. And it's more important for us to move forward than to continue to beat the past. So I tend to be a little bit of a cheerleader for anybody that's willing to do better. And I do hope they pull themselves out of it and do better. You know, there are other people that we have to boycott and they kind of take a different approach. And I find that really counterintuitive but problematic for us. Because if you tell a company that no matter what they're going to do, you're never going to support them, what incentive is there for them to do better? So I think we have to be willing to let them grow as much as we also as individuals try to grow ourselves.
Chelsea Sexton, it's always a pleasure. It's been a pleasure to talk with you. It's been a great conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us this hour for Urbanite Radio Stories on The Mark Steiner Show. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's free monthly magazine of ideas and innovation. This month, Urbanite gets on board our transportation future with stories on how electric cars could change the city, the battle for the streets between drivers and bicyclists, and a possible second act for the great American streetcar. Urbanite is available at over 700 locations around the region and online at urbanitebaltimore.com. The Mark Steiner Show is produced by the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're engineered by Zachary Coleman. Our interns are Judith Floyd, Brian Boone, Brad Kolodner, and Devon Finlay. Our theme music is by Juan Matthews of Clean Cuts. And to hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, and hear additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.